Hey, everyone. I'm Amy Standen, Ear Hustle's editor.
And I'm Rahsaan New York Thomas, Ear Hustle producer. And do you believe, Amy, they left us alone to kick off the fundraiser?
We better not blow it, Rahsaan. The stakes are high.
We're going to blow it. We just have to find new jobs, I guess. This is the second Ear Hustle fundraiser I've been here for, and I never knew how much the show relies on listener support.
It really, really does. From now through the end of this season in June, our goal is to reach 1,000 donors.
So, Amy, for folks who donate, should we tell them where that money goes?
Sure. These donations help fund our ongoing work, but also things like getting us into prisons where we've never been before. Like if you enjoyed our episode about the hospice program at CMF, or the ones we've done with the women we've been meeting at the world's largest women's prison, CCWF. And there's also some really cool behind-the-scenes stuff, like developing an Ear Hustle curriculum for high school teachers.
Listener donations support all of that. Plus, this year, supporters will be invited to join us for a virtual party on June 13th, and they get a playlist of songs picked by the team.
And everyone who donates $10 a month or more will get access to Ear Hustle Plus, which is our new subscription service with ad-free episodes and bonus content.
Find out more and donate at earhustlesq.com.
Listener support means so much to us. Thank you. Should we give the mic back to Nigel Nerland now?
Not yet. We just got it.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare.
All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is Sam Lewis, Executive Director of ARC, the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. The following episode of Ear Hustle contains language and content that might not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised.
I noticed this while we were talking to someone, and I tried not to get distracted by it. So there's a medical table, and then on the wall over the table are six dispensers with cereal in them. So there's Corn Flakes, Rice Krispies, Bran Flakes, Apple Whirls, Honey Nuts, and Fruit Whirls. Do you work here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's up with the cereal here?
Well, you know, we try to be a five-star area back here, you know, not like the rest of the areas.
It's nice. It's also colorful.
I fill it up every morning. I don't like it when it's not full. It just looks better when it's nice and full.
Which one do you think is most popular?
Actually, the Apple Jacks. The Apple Jacks and the Cheerios, Honey Nut Cheerios. It's kind of sweet, but it's kind of healthy. So you get a little bit of both worlds there. Yeah. These guys, they don't like what comes on their tray, or they just certain things, they don't want it. I'm sure, like your kids, if you have children, I have children, that's one thing you could always get them to eat, you know. And as we get older, we kind of revert back to our childish state again.
This was really not an ordinary prison, Erlon.
Honey Nut Cheerios. I like Honey Nut Cheerios.
Did you ever have those in prison?
No.
Yeah, so we've been wanting to check out this place for a while. It's a prison hospice.
It took a lot of negotiation, but we finally made it in. So that's where we're taking listeners today.
I'm Nigel Poor.
I'm Erlon Woods, and this is Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
So the history of this prison hospice is pretty interesting. It was started back in the 80s at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic.
Back then, if you were incarcerated in California and became sick with AIDS, there was this one men's prison they sent you to, CMF, also known as the California Medical Facility near Sacramento.
So you can imagine back then, you have all these sick young men in one prison, often alone, far from their families, dying of this terrible disease that at the time, really very few people understood. And the idea of the hospice was to bring some comfort and compassion and really a sense of dignity to their final days.
To get there, after you go through security, you gotta walk down this long-ass hallway.
The long-ass hallway. I don't know if listeners remember, we've talked about long-ass hallways before in prisons, and I've never seen one, so I have to admit, I was a little bit excited.
Was it long?
It was truly a long-ass hallway.
So we had to stand there for a bit and just take in the scene.
So this is just the long hallway that goes through the prison, and I don't know where people are coming and going to, but it's really busy and there's so many great sounds.
So there's this is X corridor. It just happens to be X. And
this is Dr. Michelle DeThomas. She's the medical director for the hospital, and she led us down the long hallway to a door on the right. We just walked into the hospice area. It smells very different than the rest of the prison. I'm trying to identify the smell in here.
It looked kind of like a regular hospital ward with the nurses stationed at the center of it. And then you had these rooms all around for the patients. It was like a ring of rooms.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a pleasant. Maybe it's the garden wafting out.
Can we come in? Nigel. Can we come in?
My friend Mario.
Oh, hi, Mario. So we walked into one of the rooms and were introduced to a patient named Mario.
How are you?
They want to know how you like it here.
Excellent. I love it.
Mario was wearing this blue knit hat that was kind of...
Almost bigger than his head?
Yes.
Can I ask you about your hat? Where'd you get your hat? Did someone make that for you?
This morning.
We have a group that crochets, and all the patients usually get one. They'll come and ask them what their favorite football team maybe or their favorite color, and they crochet them up.
This is one of the incarcerated guys who work in the hospice.
So they have like a knitting circle?
Yes, they do.
We have one of our workers here, Billy Ray, and he's bigger than me, big muscular Marine. And I always tell him, Sashay, you pretty little ass on down there, crochet class. And all the tough guys sit around and they crochet hats for the patients. And it's just sweet as hell. So much, you know, love into these hats, and the patients love them.
He's going to rock it out.
Uh-oh. All right.
Oh, he brought the boom box.
A couple of rooms over, we met another patient, a guy named Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, and he was also this tiny wisp of a man lying in the bed. You could barely register that there was a body there underneath all those sheets and blankets. But he was getting a visit from the music therapist.
We're going to sing it, right? Because you love this song. Hey, you good looking. What you got cooking?
This visit with Mr. Roberts made us rethink some of what we had hoped to do on this reporting trip.
Yeah, I think we were hoping to really get to know people.
Mm-hmm.
And based on some of their conditions, that wasn't possible.
I mean, a lot of these people we were meeting here were at this point where they were withdrawing. And I felt uncomfortable intruding during this really profound transition. I mean, Erlon, we were strangers to them.
Right. I mean, I think this trip became less about one individual person and more about hospice itself, you know?
All right.
Thank you. Have a good day.
But you know what? There were some surprises.
Hi, Alan. How long have you been here?
24 hours.
Alan looked like he was in his 60s, but it was a little hard to tell. He was in a wheelchair, really hunched over. He told us he had cancer and had chosen to spend his last months here in the prison hospice.
they say there's four stages to accepting a scenario like this. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Yeah.
So I'm going through all four of those stages.
And E, you weren't in the room at this point, so it was just me and our editor, Amy, and she was holding the microphone, and she had to really lean in close to Alan because his voice was so faint, and there were these really long pauses. And I got to tell you, I had a real moment there. I just felt uncomfortable and awkward, and it was like, what are we doing here? What are we trying to get from these people?
So Amy stepped up and took over while you got your shit together.
Exactly.
What stage are you at right now, do you think?
I guess I'm accepting it. Had a pretty good life. I have a master's degree in psychology. And I survived Marine Corps boot camp. So I guess I'm ready to go.
How do you feel about that? Is that scary or not?
No, not so much. Sorry, I can't think of anything.
Now, you look like you're thinking very hard.
Just riding the wave.
Is there anything we should ask you or anything you'd like to say?
Gosh, I wish I had gone to the office more.
That's a good one.
I know. That cracked me up. And you know what I think, Erlon? That comment kind of helped me get back on track.
All right. I mean, you know, it's just another conversation about weird shit. We do it all the time.
I never met a drug I didn't like. Although it's been 30 years since I did any LSD.
What was your favorite drug?
God, so many. Methylene, DMT. It's a short-acting psychedelic.
Can you describe what that feels like?
It's kind of like the visual perception of LSD, but it's all in about an hour.
This is hard to hear, but what Amy just asked him was, did your ego die?
Not so much with DMT, mushrooms, and the LSD. You could say that.
What does that feel like?
It's ineffable. I think that's the word for it.
Do you think that death might feel anything like that?
I wouldn't think so. The light goes out. You're done with all the pain. Man, I had almost 10,000 songs on my iTunes. That's a bummer. I'll not be able to hear those again. Oh well, I guess I'm done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we just stepped out into a garden that's behind, I guess, the hospice unit. Looks like there's a fountain out here. There's little covered areas. It's very pleasant. There's a view of the hills in the background. There's lots of plants around here. It looks like you can stroll around.
For the most part, the hospice looked like a pretty regular hospital,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, totally.
But this garden they have is like one of those Zen-type meditation gardens, you know?
I'm getting very excited just thinking about it. I have never seen anything like it in a prison before. And I'm going to use two words to describe it that I never think about when I think of prison.
What's that?
It was delightful and exhilarating and also restful.
That's three.
Three. Okay, three words. And basically, it's the heart of the hospice program.
So, starting up here, we have our citronella, and that is the plant there with the pinkish thing. They call that the mosquito plant. It repels the mosquitoes. They don't like this.
One of the incarcerated workers here gave us a tour of all the plants.
And these are currants, and the currants, you could eat the berries. So they usually come out a light, a medium, and a dark berry.
People warned us, if you talk to this guy, you are going to get a very extensive tour of this garden.
Okay, now we have this. This is a desert willow. We'll go around, we'll see the butterfly plants. Right here we have our lavender.
Chicks and hens.
And we have a lot of little lizards that fly around here. So here's your elderberry. Now that's the one that has medicinal...
Eventually, we extricated ourselves from this very thorough tour.
Yes, we did.
Because we'd heard there was someone else we should be talking to.
Well, he has a hoe with him.
Oh, he really does have a hoe with him. He wasn't kidding. You tend the garden?
Have we started recording?
Yes.
Oh, we never turned off the recorder.
My name is Joe Bick, and I am a physician who's been working in the Department of Corrections for the last 30 years this month.
This guy is the head honcho of health services for all California prisons. He's a real bigwig. But on this day, he was just a regular gardener.
One of the things I was thinking about standing out here is that I see something here that I haven't seen at any other prison in the United States, and that is areas of shade, quiet, and that there's a little bit of privacy that's created by the arbor here. And so this actually oddly does not feel like being in prison. And when you look at it, you realize it's not that hard to create this, but it certainly isn't created in very many spaces.
Thank you for that feedback. That's exactly what we're trying to capture. All of this was done in consultation with the people who were living and dying here and the people that work here, asking them, what is it that you want in this space? People said, I want to put my feet in the grass. And people will come out here and lay in that grass. You know, I want the movement of a swing. I want to see things moving, like this tree, this chautauqua that was picked because it sways in the wind. It has beautiful flowers.
Yeah. You feel like you can meander out here, which is not something you can really do inside of a prison.
You can, and you can find your space. There are people that want a space with a lot of people who want to talk. There are other people, they're facing death. They want a space where they're more private, that they can be by themselves, or maybe they and their family want someplace that's private.
I want to lie down there so much.
You can.
Can I?
You can.
I'm going to lie down here, sorry.
Isn't it just like a nice place to sit down?
Oh, just to lie down and look up.
In this grass?
Erlen, I can barely express to you how astonishing it was to lie down in that grass.
Yeah.
And you...
I just couldn't do it.
Why not? Why couldn't you join me down there?
Well, I mean, you know, there's some things that, you know, you can do and there's some things that I can't do.
But you can't get prone?
No, I can, but, you know, I'm not there no more like that, so.
Huh?
Yeah, I know.
I don't understand what that means.
I know. I can't do it. I'm not there no more like that, so. That don't make sense to you, Nigel?
No, I think I get what you're saying.
As a previous prisoner, there's some things that I probably won't do just on the strength of doing it.
Okay, I get it. But Erlen, it was glorious.
Oh, you looked very peaceful.
I was.
So I've really been enjoying lying on that grass down there.
Oh, sure, I lay on it too.
Joining me and we can talk
down
there?
Yeah.
So I decided this was going to be a really great place to do an interview. And Erlen, you didn't mind holding the mic.
No, I had to stand there and do production work, Nigel.
What a team.
My name is Jeff Maria, and I'm sitting in the hospice garden.
Are you really sitting?
Oh, I am laying down on a bed of grass. I'm looking up at the blue sky. Smells good out here. Nice fresh air, and got the sun on my face. Just laying on the grass, like when I was a kid.
Yeah, what do you think about when you're out here laying on the grass right now?
I'm living in the moment.
Yeah, Erlen, I was so struck by this experience that in prison, you know, there was this real sense of ease and relaxation. And we're not just in prison, we're in a hospice where people are dying. Right. And yet there was this really connective, beautiful moment lying in that grass with him and talking. We'll never forget it.
I don't think he's going to forget that either. When the last time you laid down with a woman and had a conversation?
In the grass? Forever. Forever. I mean, I've been in prison myself 44 years now, ever since I was 17 years old.
Jeff is what's called a PCS, or Pastoral Care Service Worker. He's an incarcerated guy here at the prison, and his job here is to care for the men who are dying. And when a person is really at the end of their life, like the doctors say they are 72 hours away from death, Jeff and the other incarcerated workers start a vigil.
So that means that at all times, a PCS worker is by their bedside so that no person has to die alone.
Do you think there's such thing as a good death?
Absolutely.
What is it?
I think it's the patient is comfortable. He doesn't have a lot of fear. You know, I mean, everybody can be anxious about the unknown, but if he's comfortable, he has people around him that he trusts, so he doesn't feel vulnerable. We do what we can to bring the family in to him, either, you know, on the video or in person. A lot of times we'll roll their whole bed out here, and then the family will be out here, and they can stay out here and visit all day with them.
Do you talk to them about their fears?
Sure. I'm there to hold their hand if that makes them feel better, or just listen to them. Sometimes they just like to tell stories about their life. Sometimes, you know, they will talk to you about things that they're ashamed of or they feel bad and they want to get it off their chest and let it go. It's not creepy or weird like you might think, or scary. It's, at least for me, it's nothing like that.
What is it?
I think it's sacred. I think it's a privilege, it's an honor that somebody that's in their most vulnerable state allows you to be in that space with them.
Do you think it is the worst thing to die in prison?
Well, it's relative, right? It depends on the person. We've had patients that have been in prison a long time that have nobody and nothing out there, and they're like, you know, I'm good here. I'm getting taken care of here. I'm comfortable, and I'm okay.
I'm Alan Krenitsky, PCS worker here. This is my friend.
I'm Jerry Judson. I'm also a PCS worker here.
We met Alan earlier when he was taking care of Mario.
The guy with the knit cap.
Right. And at this point, Alan was taking a break in the garden with his friend Jerry.
You know, we're really lucky that we have the opportunity to do something like this. These kind of chances just don't exist behind bars. It's a way for us to make amends for the wrongs that we've done in our lives. So I'm very grateful.
There's sometimes when someone passes away, it's very traumatic. You know, there's sometimes I'll tag out. We had the guy here, he had bone cancer. I mean, he was so young. He was too young. He was in his 20s. And it breaks your freaking heart. That's several times a day, every day. You know, he's a kid. And there was one point, and they said he wanted me going to give him a back rub. I had to tag out with somebody else. I can't do it right now. I need to go out in the garden to cry. Dude's in his 20s. He's a kid. It's hard, you know? But as much as I tell myself, like, I can't do this anymore, this is hard, this is too hard, I tell myself that as I'm walking up the hallway to come to work.
What is it about you as individuals that... think about it. Really think about it. And don't be modest. But why? Like, why are you so compassionate? Why do you give so much care?
I caused someone to die without a loved one sitting there and telling them, hey, it's going to be all right. It's going to be okay. We love you. We're here with you. Mm-hmm. So what can I do now is to be there for those that don't have that.
The guilt is real.
You have to be
down, huh?
We handed you down. Is that okay?
That's all right. Yes, I'm okay with it.
Can you introduce yourself?
My name's Michael Powell. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And I'm being treated for brain cancer.
So, Michael, he's kind of this big, very pale guy. And Erlon, remember he was wearing that cap on his head that looked like it had all kinds of electrodes coming out of it?
Like a gang of quarters?
Yeah, it looked like quarters on his head. I mean, it was clearly some kind of treatment he was getting. Yeah. And you're out in the garden?
Yes.
And the nurses were going to walk you around?
I walk by myself out here, but they check on me all the time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you think about this garden?
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I came from a place that, medical treatment for inmates is kind of lacking, so.
And what?
Sorry.
That's okay. It's hard.
And well, they misdiagnosed me for 2.5 years, so. 2.5 years is important.
It is. Yeah. What were your symptoms during that time?
Severe headaches. So they said I had sinus infections. So that's what they treated me for. And then I went to, saw a real doctor. And he said, this ain't no sinus infection. You have a tumor. And within 5 days, they took it out.
And how long ago was that?
January 16th.
January. So that's about 5 months.
Right.
5 months ago.
Right. So the cancer that I have, they say 24 months after diagnosis.
Oh. That's a lot to take in for anybody.
Yeah. After doing 20 years in prison, yeah.
So how...
I apologize.
Don't just have to apologize. I wish I could hold your hand. I'm not allowed to, but I'm sorry that you've been feeling this way. Yeah.
Michael was expecting to be released from prison in about 5 years, but the cancer diagnosis makes it unlikely he'll live that long.
So he's applying for what's called compassionate release. It's a California law that lets people apply to be released from prison if a doctor says they're at the very end of their life.
The place they're trying to send me to is by my family. I look forward to just go out and have a hamburger.
Yeah.
Maybe some pizza.
Yeah. Why do you want a hamburger?
Oh, we very rarely get real meat around here, so.
True, yeah, yeah. If you could take a walk anywhere, where would you go?
Beach.
Yeah, go to the beach. Yeah, I hope you get to do that.
I will.
What's the best part of the day for you?
Writing a letter, coming out here and hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what are the most difficult times of the day?
Getting up in the morning.
Really? Why?
I'm still here.
So isn't that a good feeling, though, when you wake up in the morning and you're still here? I mean, that you're still alive.
Yes. Well, the still alive part, yeah, but no one wants to die against me.
No.
You just don't want to die in custody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it the pain that's more scary than the emotional part?
I've been stabbed. I've been shot at more times than I know of. And I've never been scared of that, but knowing it's coming, I think, is... But not, you don't know when.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I could get hit by a bus the day I get out. So,
yeah.
Who knows? I just don't want to be miserable when I go. So. Excuse me.
Mr. Powell, when we came out here, what were you about to do out here?
Just walk.
Just walk?
Yeah. Yes.
What part of the garden do you like to spend time in?
Oh, over there, there's hummingbirds down there by the swings.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And do you hang out in that swing?
Yeah, I sit over there. Yeah. Usually on the sunny side, though. Just get some sun.
Yeah. Can we walk over there with you?
Yeah.
So you say this is where the hummingbirds come?
They come over here. They'll be by in a minute.
I remember we sat there for a while with him, just kind of quietly swinging on the bench in the gazebo. And I think the garden was doing what it was supposed to do. It was really peaceful.
On that note, I think we should take a break.
Let's do it.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, here to tell you about a great mystery. That mystery is you. As the host of a podcast called Hidden Brain, I explore big questions about what it means to be human. Questions like, where do our emotions come from? Why do so many of us feel overwhelmed by modern life? How can we better understand the people around us? Discover your hidden brain. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Ear Hustle comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/earhustle. That's odoo.com/earhustle. Odoo. Modern management made simple. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. Hear a feed from episodes across NPR podcasts that center Black voices. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Chaplain Keith Knopf. I'm the director of pastoral care in the hospice here. And I've been here for 27 years.
All prisons have chaplains, but here at the hospice, it's a little different.
You know, there's a part of Knopf's job that's like being a private eye. Because a lot of these men haven't seen their families in decades. And sometimes they want to make contact again before they die.
So a lot of our patients, they come to us and they haven't had contact with their families in 20, 30 years. And it's for a lot of different reasons. We have, you know, 30 plus institutions in the state of California, and they get lost in the shuffle. And so then they just lose where the family member is. And sometimes because of the crimes, they back away.
Yeah.
And so in our hospice, though, we want to make sure that we locate families so that they can be notified, and also to give them an opportunity for some kind of restoration so that the patient can make amends with the families, so there can be some reconciliation to take place, so the families can receive some closure, and so our patients can leave this world having closure for themselves as well.
Knopf told us about this one guy who had lost touch with his family.
The guy told Knopf that he had an aunt and uncle who had died and four cousins, but he had no idea where they were.
So Knopf had to track them down.
I prayed about it, and I thought about the fact that the aunt and uncle had a house, and that house probably was sold. And so I knew where the address was. I called the various realtors in the area, and I found out who sold the house. And I asked them if they could give me the name of the company, and they did. So I called the title company, and I knew that there would be one of those daughters who would have had been the executrix of the estate. And the next thing I know, there's four cousins wanting to see him. They didn't know he was in prison. And it was great.
Wow.
It was great fun. So that, just bringing them together so they had closure. They knew what happened to him and why he was here. In my 27 years, I've had maybe only two, maybe three of the family members who said, I don't want anything to do with them. One even said that they considered the patient less than plant life. So just let me know when they die. But all the other ones that we've located, they wanted to have some kind of reconciliation, some kind of closure.
Another part of Knopf's job is to help people decide what kind of death they want to have.
And as much as possible, I guess, help them face their end with some kind of acceptance and maybe even peace. How do you comfort people in this moment where there's so much anxiety? I imagine for a lot of people, it's really an anxious time and a fearful time. So how do you, like, sit with them and touch them and talk to them?
Oh, with
and
their
listen?
Patients?
Yeah.
I usually talk to them about hope and what gives them hope. We'll talk about things of faith. We'll talk about their hope to reconcile with their family members, to make amends with those that they've injured.
Can you hold their hand? Or
oh, yeah.
You can.
Yeah, I'll give them a hug. I'll hold their hand, be there for them.
Is that different than other?
I'll read to them. We'll write to them. And then our pastoral care inmate workers, they're the heroes. They're the ones that are there making sure that no one dies alone. Some of our Buddhists, there have been two that wanted to die alone. They wanted to be mindful of their last breath. They wanted to have their head propped up and so they can project their essence into a higher plane and then be reincarnated on a higher level. They didn't want to have any kind of distractions, and they didn't want a lot of pain meds. They wanted some to take the edge off, but they wanted to be alert. And they wanted to die with a clarity of knowing this life to the next.
Knopf told us about one patient in particular, a Buddhist man who was preparing to die in hospice.
We were in the wings just in case he wanted something, but he wanted definitely to be alone, to be mindful. We were not there right at the moment of his death because he wanted to be alert and he wanted to be alone, but we were hovering. So we'd kind of walk by and look in, hover around, you know, and need anything without bothering him too much. And the nursing staff, of course, their job is to check on him, but he didn't want anything else. He didn't want somebody holding his hand. He just wanted to be left alone.
If you're sitting with someone who's dying, in the process of dying, what's, in your opinion, what is the best thing? Like, what advice would you give me to be present for somebody?
Don't talk so much. Listen more. Listen for their heartbeat. Have your breathing coincide with their breathing. Just kind of tune into them and just listen. And then if words come, let the words come. But mostly let them speak. Sometimes they speak with their eyes. Sometimes they're too weak to speak, and they can blink, you know. One blink for yes, two blinks for no, that kind of thing. Sometimes they can squeeze a hand a little bit. You know, you just let them know that you're there. For a lot of the guys, they know that God forgives them, but they have a hard time forgiving themselves when they think about what they've done.
I want to be compassionate, and I understand that people can't live a life completely in shame, but there's sometimes where I feel like it's right. You should. You should really struggle with what you did and how deeply you affected so many lives. So how do we come to terms with that as like a caring person whose heart is open to not wanting people to suffer?
I see my job as to help them open up to those things and to take ownership of those things. But they may not be ready for that. We had a patient back here who slaughtered his wife in front of five daughters. He had a real bad anger management issue and his own problems, and he just totally lost it one evening at the table, slaughtered his wife with a knife. His daughters saw this, and they were little.
Even in this situation, Knopf felt like maybe there was some good that could happen here.
So he went in search of the daughters to ask if they wanted to see their dad again.
So I was able to find those daughters through the Eastern Orthodox Church, and they wanted to come and visit, and they wanted to ask him questions. Why did you do this, Dad? You know, what was this all about? And
who prepared those women for the experience of meeting him?
Well, we did, yeah. I talked to them before they came in. I mentioned to them that they'll be remembering things from the vantage point of a little child. And I said, now he's just sucked up old guy. And he's weak physically.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have power over them, but he wants to see them too. And they saw that as a kindness. We prepared him for the meeting as well. In his culture, the husband, the father, is the one in charge. And I said, you lost that when you killed your wife, especially in front of these daughters, and they're going to remember you as this monster. You don't have that control anymore. You don't have that authority. They're in control. They can walk out at any time. They're calling the shots. And so we had the meeting, and he wanted to take control a couple times, and can't do that. They're in charge.
Did you step in and say?
Yeah, I stepped in. And so that made them feel, empowered. They made it through really good. They showed him pictures of his grandchildren, and they showed pictures of their graduation from college. And he had missed all these things because of what he did. And he was able to express sorrow, for his crime and what he did. But there was one time when one of them asked him, well, why did you do this? And then he started to complain about his wife, and then they shut him down. You don't complain about mom. That still was in him.
Yeah.
He couldn't reach that point of taking ownership over his own actions.
So when you told me that, my interior started to boil a little bit and get angry. What happened inside of you when you...
It boiled, yeah.
Okay, all right. Who do you think that experience benefited the most?
I think it benefited the daughters because they were able to confront him. They were able to see him. They had closure. They saw that he was no longer this monster, that he was a confused old man who hadn't really grown a whole lot from when he was their dad years and years ago.
How did it end? Did they touch or exchange?
Yes, they shook hands. He wanted to hug them, but they weren't ready for that. So they shook hands on the way out, So there was at least some kind of touch.
Any, I love yous or?
No I love yous, but there was closure. They did say that they forgave him. Forgiveness isn't agreeing with the crime or the hurt. It's putting it away. If you look at the word in an old dictionary, you see it's a collision of two English words, the for and then evenness. And for is what you hit the golf ball, you send it away.
Yeah.
And the idea of evenness, so for evenness, you send that infraction, you send that crime, you send that ouchiness of your heart away.
I feel that we don't really understand what the word forgiveness means,
mm-hmm.
and it gets used way too lightly,
mm-hmm.
and so I really appreciate hearing
that
how you talk
effort.
About
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not just, oh, I forgive you.
And it doesn't necessarily mean a happy ending either, right?
No,
it's not always about coming back together and hugging. It's about, as you said, like understanding something and moving on. But it's really complicated. And evenness, that's not an easy thing.
It wasn't for these five brave daughters. It wasn't an easy thing for them. Yeah. But they wanted to do that.
Man.
So hospice is a place of healing.
Yeah.
You know, not just a place of dying.
If I asked you what you did for a living and you couldn't say chaplain, what are like three words you would use to describe what you do, what your job is?
Spiritual midwife, helping a person be birthed from this life to the next. Yeah, spiritual birth.
Nice. I think that's a pretty good ending. Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Do you remember when we were trying? We were trying to remember how long ago it was.
About 3.5 weeks.
Okay.
Four weeks. Yeah.
A few weeks later, we went back to CMF's hospice for a second visit.
We saw Michael Powell, the guy with the brain tumor who we had met in the garden.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How you doing today?
I'm good. Let's get the mic on you.
Uh-oh. I didn't do it. It wasn't me.
And man, he seemed better.
Amazing.
I do remember.
He was hanging out with a service dog who was assigned to the hospice, a golden retriever named Angelica.
She's my little buddy.
Can you describe who Angelica, what is it? Who
Angelica
is Angelica?
Angelica is a service dog that's been here a while, and she's a very loving dog that enjoys coming in here and hanging out with us.
What does it mean when she licks you?
That's just an emotional feeling, like she's trying to get to know somebody.
Oh, okay, so it's a good sign.
Yes.
There were two things I wanted to ask you about. Last time when we met, you cried quite a bit.
Yeah. And you caught me on a bad day.
We were strangers. I felt awkward, and it's so hard in prison because you can't comfort. I mean, I'm not allowed to comfort anybody. I couldn't reach out, and I felt so terrible about it, but I didn't quite know why you were crying. I wasn't sure if it was emotional or physiological. So I was glad we got to talk again.
Well, I think emotionally I've changed a little bit. It was a large tumor. I have noticed that some of my thinking has changed a little bit. So I imagine that had something to do with my emotional state at the time.
Were you irritated that these strangers were talking to you and you were crying?
No. I'm that's not my personality. It's just a weird situation. I'm a control person. I like being in control. And I'm not in control of anything right now.
I mean, I know it's only been 3.5 weeks since we saw you, but you actually seem stronger than when
we
saw you.
Oh, yeah. I walk every day. I go do squats. I walk. I hang out with her every day. We walk.
Your voice sounds stronger, too.
I feel good, really, other than not knowing about the tumor. The tumor can come back anytime, and I'm not going to know. You know, I'm not going to know.
Michael was still waiting to see whether his application for compassionate release had been granted.
Again, that's the California law that lets some people get out of prison when a doctor says they're at the end.
And now that Michael was feeling better, you could sense this real urgency. Like, this was his window to live, reconnect with his family.
And he didn't know how long that window would stay open. So if I asked you to look to, the, like, 3 months from now, Where do you think you're going to be in 3 months?
Hopefully in Crescent City. I'm hoping my health improves. Oh, my sister said she'll come spend the weekends with me. So.
And what do you imagine you would do together?
Go shopping. I haven't been to a grocery store in 20 years. I haven't had a hamburger in 20 years.
Yeah. Well, it's great to see you again. Honestly, you look so much better than you did 3.5 weeks
ago. Thank you for coming back.
Erlon, the thing that I remember about leaving that day that was really striking was like the contrast between the quiet, sacred space of death and dying that actually felt comforting in some ways, and then contrasting that with the loud, kind of chaotic scene in that long-ass hallway of the regular prison.
Can I get your visitor pass, too?
It's almost time for Diet Coke.
You and your Diet Coke, Nige.
Hey, you know me well, and I know you wanted to get back to your phone.
Nah, my sunflower seeds.
Okay. Well, after spending a day in there, as beautiful as it was, it did actually feel good to get back to the routine of, you know, just like regular life stuff.
Indeed it do.
Thank you for calling Crescent City's Skill Nursing. This is Alina. How may I help you?
We're hoping to reach Michael Powell.
Yeah, give me a sec. Hold on.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hello, Michael.
Is this Michael?
Yeah, this is Michael.
Is this Michael Freeman?
No, this is Michael Freeman. Yes. Yes, it is.
That's what's
Hi, up. Michael Freeman.
A few months later, we got on the phone with Michael Powell.
The compassionate release came through. He'd been released from prison to go live in a nursing home up in Crescent City, right by the Oregon border.
And that was this cool story he told us about when he was being transferred from prison to the nursing home in an ambulance.
It turned out the ambulance drivers had also done time in prison. So they were like, hey, let's show this guy some sights.
We stopped somewhere, the world's biggest tree, and they let me out of the van, to step out of the van. And that was my first step for freedom, not handcuffed, not chains, not in orange, and that meant a lot. We were in the parking lot in the trees, just beautiful. It was fresh air, beautiful trees, big old redwood trees.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the excitement of I'm free now.
Yeah.
You know, a cop drove by, I don't care. I didn't do nothing. I don't know if it was the freedom or it was the air, the beauty of it. And then we stopped and looked at the ocean. Yeah.
I'm so glad you saw that. I think that's a really special part of California. It feels like a place that's very alive. Just
it feels new.
Yeah.
It feels like it's, you're right, it feels like it's new, like it's untouched, like it's, I don't want to say a virgin, but a virgin.
But there's something
but
like that.
But I want to feel like it's not corrupted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I absolutely.
It was beautiful. We'll see what happens. You know?
Hey.
A couple months after we spoke to him, and about a week before this episode came out, Michael Powell died in the nursing home where we last spoke to him.
He died a free man.
Yes, he did.
Mario Rivas, the guy with the hat, and Mr. Roberts, who sang Hank Williams, also died at the CMF hospice.
I'm glad we got to spend some time with them.
Indeed.
I had the flu in the prison infirmary. My last day I looked up and saw a man wheeled around the corner, down to skin and bones, that's all. I asked the nurse where he was going. She said, hospice down the hall. He probably won't be in there long. Any day we'll get the call.
That's a bit of Bonnie Raitt's song, Down the Hall.
She wrote this song after reading about the hospice program at the California Medical Facility in the New York Times.
That's pretty cool.
It is.
Hey, everyone. My name is Michelle DeThomas, and right now I'm having a little moment of gratitude that you all took the time to visit our hospice and share these important stories. Ear Hustle is produced by Nigel Poor, Erlon Woods, Amy Standen, Bruce Wallace, and Rasan New York Thomas. Shabnam Zygmunt is the managing producer. The producing team inside San Quentin includes Darrell Sadiq Davis, Tony DeTrinidad, and Tom Nguyen. The inside managing producer is Tony Tafoya. Thanks to Acting Warden Cueva at the California Medical Facility for welcoming the Ear Hustle team and supporting the hospice mission to provide dignity at the end of life for our patients and their families. Thanks also to this amazing woman here.
My name is Lieutenant Priscilla Gonzalez. I'm the Administrative Assistant and Public Information Officer for the California Medical Facility, and I approve this episode.
Big thanks to Acting Warden Andis and Lieutenant Barry at San Quentin, and Acting Warden Williams, Associate Warden Lewis, and Lieutenant Newborg at the California Institution for Women for their ongoing support of the show. This episode was made possible by the Just Trust, working to amplify the voices, vision, and power of communities that are transforming the justice system. For more information about this episode, check out the show notes on Ear Hustle's website, earhustlesq.com. You can also find out more about the show on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at Ear Hustle SQ.
Erlon Woods sound designs and engineers the show with help from Fernando Arruda and Harry Colhane.
This episode features music from Rashid Zinnemann, Fernando Arruda, Antoine Williams, and me, Erlon Woods.
Want more Ear Hustle? Subscribe to Ear Hustle Plus.
We've got bonus episodes and live chats, so we get to chop it up with the listeners about the show.
And Erlon, that is always a blast.
Always. Subscribe at earhustlesq.com/plus or in the Apple Podcast app.
And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, The Lowdown. In this issue, I'm going to be talking about a little photo project I'm doing on the side. There's actually a connection to this episode, but you're going to have to read it to find out.
Nigel, you got a side piece.
I'm stepping out on you, Erlon.
Wee! Subscribe at earhustlesq.com/newsletter. And while you're at it, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That's a big help to the show, and we appreciate you for it.
Ear Hustle is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, creator-owned, listener-supported podcasts.
Discover audio with vision at radiotopia.fm.
I'm Nigel Poor.
I'm Erlon Woods.
Thanks for listening.
Jasmine. You're Jasmine right here. And that has a little smile too. This is your Philadelphus Louisi right here. And that has like a four-leaf clover when it does flower and flowered earlier and it's a white.
It's Erlon.
And Nigel.
Here again, reminding you to donate to our spring fundraiser today so we can keep bringing you more Ear Hustle.
Everyone who donates will be invited to our virtual party on June 13th. If you've never been, it's a fun time where we talk about the season and answer some of your questions live. Uncensored, live.
And I will be on the hologram so y'all can see me.
3DE.
On Zoom. Every donation, any amount, will help us reach our goal. So please go to earhustlesq.com to learn more and please contribute.
Thank you.
If you can find it in your heart, in your pocket, in your wallet, in the couch.
Radiotopia.